Thank you. Be seated.
If you were here this morning, you heard the yell yay.
Just have to kind of imagine.
The court has two more matters on its oral submission docket. In the order in which they'll be presented, they are Cincinnati Life Insurance Company and others versus R.B. Edmund Tate Sr. and others from Bowie County, and Perry Homes Contractors Incorporated versus the Honorable Jay Patterson on original mandamus proceeding. In each of these matters, each side has 20 minutes to present oral arguments. The relator or petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal. We'll take a brief recess in between each argument. You may purchase a tape of these arguments from the clerk of our court if you're so inclined. And the court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Cincinnati versus Tate.
May it please the court, Mr. Andrew Zelinski and Mr. Rob Burgess, gentlemen, petitioner. Petitioner will reserve 2 minutes to rebuttal. Mr. Zelinski will open with the first 13 minutes.
My name is Andy Zelinski, and I represent three of the petitioners on this appeal: Northwestern, Central Life, and Phoenix Mutual Life Insurance Companies. They've been referred to as the Northwestern Group throughout the appeal, although they are different insurance companies. In December 1993, the Northwestern Group filed a motion for summary judgment based on four separate grounds. The grounds were set forth in the motion, they were argued and briefed, and the trial court considered and ruled on all four of those grounds. The trial court expressly granted two of the grounds and expressly denied two of the grounds. The two grounds that were denied were the statute of limitations and no damages grounds. On appeal, the Northwestern Group properly raised and preserved by Crosspoint the two grounds that were denied to support affirmance of the trial court's judgment. And the Court of Appeals declined to consider those two grounds, which is why we're here today. We believe the Court of Appeals erred in not considering those two grounds and in remanding the case without first considering those two grounds. It's important to note that with respect to these two grounds, they were set forth in the motion. They were argued by the parties. They were briefed by the parties. They were presented to the trial court. They were contemplated and ruled on by the trial court. They became part of the final judgment. They were also properly raised and preserved on appeal. We believe that under existing current case law and summary judgment principles, that these grounds should have been considered, and all these factors that I just stated all justify considering these grounds. In other words, I believe that under current summary judgment principles, that a summary judgment ground must be contemplated and ruled on, assuming it's been properly raised and preserved for an appellate court to consider it, and I believe we met all those criteria. Alternatively, if contemplated and ruled on means contemplated and granted, which the Court of Appeals concluded that it did, to which I disagree, then I believe under Rule 81C that the appellate court that 81C, rather, is broad enough to encompass appellate review of any properly raised and preserved ground, even though the trial court does not expressly rule on it. And I think this case is a good example of why the summary judgment rules should not be so inflexible.
So it doesn't make any difference if the trial court actually denies the ground, that, or I guess the other alternative would be the trial court grants the summary judgment without reference to the specific grounds.
I think the result's the same, because if a trial court grants, for example, a broad summary judgment, I believe that under the rationale of the current case law, it's presumed that the trial court considered all grounds. If a trial court grants a summary judgment on one ground without considering the other grounds, I believe under the current law, and I realize there's some disagreement on it, but under the current law, the other grounds must be remanded so the trial court can first consider and rule on them. But the rationale being that the trial court had not yet considered them.
So the third alternative would be, as you just stated, where the trial court grants, let's say, the first ground, and doesn't reach the other three?
In that,
we couldn't render a judgment. We'd have to remand it.
I believe under the current state of the law, if the order grants it on ground A without mentioning ground B and C and D, then under the current state of the law, that it would have to be remanded. I don't think our case falls under that scenario because the trial court specifically denied our other two grounds, so there would be no reason to remand it because the trial court had already considered those grounds. The summary judgment ground that can end this case today is the statute of limitations.
Let me ask you a question before you get to the break. In your case, if we agree that we have to send this back to the Court of Appeals to rule on the grounds that the trial court specifically denied?
If you agree with my position, I do not believe it should be remanded to the Court of Appeals. I believe the Supreme Court should consider the ground because there is statutory and case law authority to do that.
On Rule 180?
I think 180 is the statutory authority, and I believe the Rogers versus Racaine case, which is a 1989 Supreme Court case, involved a situation where the Supreme Court reviewed summary judgment grounds not considered by the Court of Appeals before remanding it to the state court. So I think there's authority for this court to review those grounds. The statute of limitations ground would end this case today. This suit involves the acts of an agent, and this agent sold numerous insurance policies to the respondents. Six of those insurance companies are involved in the suit, and the others are not. With respect to the Northwestern Group, the insurance policies were sold in 1987. They all lapsed a few months later in 1987 or 1988. The causes of action that had been asserted in this case are all two-year causes of action, and the lawsuit was not filed until November of 1992. In this particular case, there were four motions for summary judgment that were granted, and they were all filed and granted at different times, so in effect, there are four summary judgment records. The Northwestern Group filed its motion for summary judgment first. Their summary judgment record shows that the only check written to the agent for insurance premiums was dated February 1988, and that's page 370 of the transcript. And the record also shows that the agent stopped collecting cash from the respondents in 1988, which is page 722 of the transcript. The record also shows that the respondents last talked to the agent in 1989, which is page 222 of the transcript. The respondents argue that that last conversation really took place in 1990 to avoid the statute of limitations, but there is no inference in the record to support that. The page they cite to, number one, was never presented to the trial court and therefore not reviewable on appeal, but more so number two, if you read that whole page, which is page 222 of the record, that whole page clearly shows that the last conversation with the agent took place in 1988. Also, there was a confrontation that took place in the last conversation was in 1989. There was a confrontation that took place between the respondent and the agent in 1989, but no earlier than 1988. And it's that confrontation which is critical to this case. The respondent confronted the agent because of the lack of correspondence from these insurance companies. And the respondent confronted the agent because he was concerned that the policies had lapsed and that he had been scammed. And his exact words were, "What the hell is going on? Look, man, something ain't right here." To which the agent responded, "Well, go do what you got to do." And this confrontation took place in either 88 or 1989, and with a two-year statute of limitations and the lawsuit being filed in November of 1992, even if you apply the discovery rule, the claims are barred by limitations. We believe that the cause of action would have accrued 1987 or 1988 when these policies lapsed. We believe that even if the discovery rule is applied, the discovery rule tolls limitations until a plaintiff discovers or should have discovered, based on reasonable diligence, the nature of the injury. And according to case law, under the discovery rule, that cause of action will accrue when the claimant is put on notice to check for injury or realizes he has sustained harm. If you fail to undertake further inquiry, the limitations are not told, they will begin. We believe that this confrontation in 1988 or 1989, regardless of the year, began the running of limitations because the agent all but told the respondent to undertake further inquiry when he said, go do what you got to do. And this lawsuit was filed more than 2 years after that point. In fact, it was filed 3 or 4 years later. We believe that the final judgment should be affirmed. The trial court's final judgment should be affirmed based on that cross point. There was an affidavit filed by one of the respondents that attempts to controvert these facts. That affidavit was filed in August of 1994, and that was 6 months after our summary judgment hearing and 3 months after the summary judgment order was signed by the court. It was actually filed in connection with one of the other motions for summary judgment, and certainly no leave of court was ever granted for it to be filed in connection with our summary judgment evidence, and therefore that affidavit is not summary judgment evidence with respect to the Northwestern group. We have allotted our time between the petitioners, to which I will give the podium to Mr. Burgess, and I believe I have 2 minutes in rebuttal after.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Ralph Burgess. I'm here on behalf of petitioner Mid-Continent Life Insurance Company. As Mr. Jabinski has mentioned, the trial court granted summary judgment to the Northwestern petitioners and the other defendants below on two specific grounds. The trial court granted summary judgment with respect to Mid-Continent on those two grounds, plus an additional two grounds, which were based on the facts that Mid-Continent had terminated the agency relationship between it and Gail Butler some 11 months before the respondents met with the agent, and additionally based on the fact that no policies were ever issued by Mid-Continent to any of the respondents. The Court of Appeals erred with respect to reviewing Mid-Continent's summary judgment because it held that each ground for relief must support the judgment independent of the other ground. In short, the Court of Appeals ruled that when a trial court grants summary judgment on the basis of specific grounds, each specific ground must by itself and without reference to the other specific grounds in the order support the judgment. That error forms the basis of our points of error 1 through 5. Our sixth point of error is identical to the first point of error by the Northwestern group, and I'm not going to address that. Mr. Jabinski has argued that and will present more on that. Now, as this court is familiar, in Lear-Sigler versus Perez, the court stated that the burden on a defendant moving for summary judgment was to disprove as a matter of law one of the essential elements of each of the plaintiff's causes of action. In this case, the plaintiffs have alleged causes of action for violations of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, the Texas Insurance Code. They've alleged causes of action for negligent processing and handling of policies, negligent hiring and supervision of the agent, failure to warn of the agent's actions, and breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Now, I will concede that each of the grounds stated in the Mid-Continent summary judgment will not by itself negate an essential element of each of those causes of action. But when the specific grounds set forth in the judgment are read together, the cumulative effect is that that an essential element of each of the plaintiff's causes of action has been negated in compliance with our burden under the Lear-Siegler case. I use as an example of this, in the first ground, the trial court stated that as a matter of law, Gail Butler had no actual, apparent, or implied authority on behalf of defendant Mid-Continent to commit any of the actions or make any of the representations complained of by the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, and therefore such actions are not imputed to such defendant, and defendant is not liable to plaintiffs for such representations. Now, the Court of Appeals, in its opinion, has stated that the first ground does not address whether Butler was acting within the scope of the agency relationship at the time of any representation, as is required by this court's ruling in Celtic Life versus Coates. But the fourth ground specifically states that as a matter of law, no agency or employment relationship existed between the agent Butler and defendant Mid-Continent at the time of any representations by Gail Butler to plaintiffs. So when you read those in connection with one another, they negate the essential element of vicarious liability, which is the plaintiffs must prove in order to prevail on their DTPA and insurance code violations. I've addressed the other grounds and how they negate other elements of cause of action in the application for writ, and I do not want to just belabor the point on that. But another problem with the opinion is that it goes further than merely requiring each ground to independently negate an essential element. It also requires the defendant to negate the possibility of a fact issue on some element not before the court. And I'm reading from page 10 of the opinion, where the court says, the determination that no policies were issued by Mid-Continent does not negate the possibility of conduct that enticed the plaintiffs to give money to Butler for the purpose of purchasing such policies. The determination that no agency or employment existed at the time the representations were made did not negate prior conduct by the principal that may have clothed Butler in an apparent agency. Now, as we pointed out in the application, in this case, the respondents have not pled apparent authority. The Court of Appeals mentions that it was briefed and presented, and therefore that issue has not been preserved. But the only mention of apparent authority is in the heading of a motion for summary judgment. It's not mentioned. There's no discussion of the argument, and it's certainly not mentioned in their petition. But I would point out to the court, as it is well aware, in the case of City of Houston versus Clear Creek Basin Authority, this court stated that specifically, no longer must the movement negate all possible issues of law and fact that could be raised by the non-movement in the trial court, but were not. So I would argue that in addition to applying the wrong standard in terms of not being able to interpret the specific grounds together, the court has gone further and has violated this court's opinion in City of Houston versus Clear Creek. And finally, I would point out that this holding by the Court of Appeals has further ramifications beyond the summary judgment issues here, in the sense that it would ensure that a company such as Mid-Continent that terminates an agent will never be able to get a summary judgment in a case like this, because we can never negate the possibility of there having been an apparent agency. And the effect of that would be that it would actually increase the company's liability for the agent's actions after he's been terminated, in the sense that now the company no longer has any control over the agent. He's been terminated, and yet they're still liable for these possible apparent agency. And my time has expired.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you for your consideration.
May it please the court, Mr. David Carter will present argument for the respondent.
Please the court, I'd like to first address this issue of whether the alternative grounds in this case are reviewable either by the Court of Appeals or by this court on appeal. Those obviously in this case are the statute of limitations and the no damage grounds that the trial court denied and that the Court of Appeals chose not to consider. And I think it may surprise the court as to how much the parties actually agree on, and that if I address that briefly, it may hone down where I think we are with this case. I think the petitioners have graciously conceded that under the existing cases that discuss this issue in the recent years, the alternative grounds in terms of what these cases hold are not to be reviewed on appeal unless they were considered and ruled on by the trial court. At the same time, I have to agree from reading those cases that all of the ones, at least that I've read, and I'm talking about State Farm and Delaney and the others, dealt with fact situations where the trial judge granted one of the grounds, granted summary judgment on one of the grounds, and simply didn't mention the alternative grounds. And in our case, the trial court did have presented to it argument and motions and briefs on these alternative grounds, and the order did, on the one hand, grant on certain grounds and specifically denied on the other grounds. So we do have that agreement. I also understand that if this court takes the position that this was a final summary judgment, that a majority of this court, in the opinions that I've read, have indicated that it's appropriate, particularly where there's a record to support it and where there's a need to resolve it and where the trial court considered these alternative grounds, to go ahead and rule on it. And I'm not here to argue any policy reasons why that should not be the law if this court is faced with a final summary judgment where the trial court considered the alternative grounds and his order denied it. And that's where I think the petitioners and the respondents are chasing different rabbits in this case, because the clearest reason why the alternative grounds in this case are not reviewable is because the trial court's orders on the summary judgments are not final. They don't resolve all issues as to all parties, because as we raised in our responses to the motions for summary judgment and in our appellate briefs, and as the Court of Appeals concluded in its opinion, excuse me, the trial court's orders did not reach the plaintiff's claims against the companies themselves. And I'm talking about primarily the negligence claims, failure to supervise and to process these the paperwork and so forth that the agent was handling over this three-year period, and to warn the plaintiffs. So,
well, in the case of Mid-Continent, do you disagree that the record shows that Mr. Butler was terminated by them a year before?
Yes, sir.
Did you allege that same claim against Mid-Continent that you're talking about?
Yes,
now?
Your Honor, I do, and I plan to address them separately in a moment, but simply stated, I think there's a fact issue that there was, in fact, actual authority at the time the agent dealt with my clients, because the summary judgment proof shows that what Mid-Continent did was put their agent on inactive status. They didn't terminate him by their own records until after he had sold the policy to my folks and started taking money from them and apparently sticking it in his pocket. So I do disagree with that. Court of Appeals did not address actual authority, but certainly there is an issue according to the Court of Appeals on apparent authority too. And if I have time, I'd like to address that in a little more detail.
Let me ask you another question. One counsel talked about the limitations question. In your view, does the limitations question cut across all defendants?
No, Your Honor. Only one movement, that's the Northwestern Group, has even brought that up on appeal. And it would only apply to one plaintiff if it were a good argument, which I'll be happy to address if time permits.
Let me ask you.
Sure.
I'm a little bit confused. Was the judgment that came before the Court of Appeals a final judgment?
I say that it was not, because...
Okay. Now, is that what you're really presenting here, is this was not a final judgment to begin with, and we're coming up now on appeal, and you're continuing that argument as the respondent, saying, look, Supreme Court, this was not a final judgment to begin with, And that's the reason why we cannot address these denied claims at this point?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor, because, and it's the Novak versus Stevens case, and there's a number of cases after that, clearly state that an order denying a summary judgment motion is not appealable, and there are three exceptions to that rule. Two of them deal with...
Well, I'm not talking about the denial. The trial court granted a summary judgment in this case. You're saying that granted summary judgment was not a final judgment?
I'm saying that the judgment that was entered by the trial court, or the order, well, I think it was actually named a judgment in, did not dispose of all issues and all parties. That's been our contention all along.
Now, Mufridge is a case that attempted to address that. If you lose on if this court determines that that initial judgment of the trial court was a final judgment, do you still win? I mean, do you still get an affirmance of the CA's opinion up here?
I think I do in this case, because if this court reaches the statute of limitations and the no damage issue, it's clear that there are fact issues. So our contention in this case, or our position, is if this court considers the issues non-reviewable, obviously the Court of Appeals should be affirmed, but even if it does consider them reviewable on the record in this case, the Court of Appeals opinion is still suspended.
Can you tell me why you say that the granting, the order that was appealed to the CA was not a final order? What was it missing that it had to have to be a final order?
Because it resolved the issues, although the Court of Appeals disagreed, the order purportedly resolved the issues on the authority of this agent and on the DTPA and insurance code issues, the motions for summary judgment, and therefore the order did not reach the claims as we pled that the companies themselves have liability primarily on a negligence theory in addition to any conduct on the part of this agent, because over this three-year period of time they allowed him to pocket the money and let these policies lapse. So,
but in Mafferty we held that if the order is final on its face, the fact that the motion didn't address all the claims or parties is simply error. It doesn't mean that the judgment's not final.
And the law that I've read and that I rely on, Your Honor, is this was addressed not directly by the Court of Appeals, but the Hood versus Amarillo National Bank case, which was a per curiam opinion of this court about 3 years ago, I think in 1991, clearly stated that if a summary judgment order does not resolve all issues as to all parties, it's interlocutory and it's not appealable. And the article by Judge Hittner and Ms. Liberato that the court referred to in its opinion discusses that at length, I think, at page 55. There's also a Tyler writ denied case, City of Tyler, and I forget the plaintiff's name, and that it was Yancey, that clearly said that if the order does not dispose of all theories of recovery, it is not a final summary judgment and therefore not appealable. So that is the clearest basis in our view as to why these issues are not reviewable. Now, if this court chooses to review them, and I'll address the ones that were mentioned, the statute of limitations ground, Northwestern is the only movement that has brought that up, and it would only arguably apply to Mr. Cates Jr. in this case, the gentleman who purchased the policies, because as they brief themselves, neither the beneficiary nor the insurer knew any of the operative facts about dealing with this agent, even after this suit were filed. So if there is a statute of limitations argument, it would only apply to one plaintiff. This suit was filed in November of 1992. I'll agree that there are two-year statute of limitations on these causes. So did the cause of action accrue any earlier than November of 1990? As this court's well aware, they would, at least on this affirmative defense of statute of limitations, have to conclusively establish both that the cause of action arose or accrued within 2 years and negate the discovery rule completely. Now,
could you refresh my memory? Is the law that if you're alleging limitations that the moving defendant has to anticipate an unpled discovery rule and lead it? Or does he get to wait until you come back with your response?
You're talking about the non-movement's burden to plead the discovery rule.
Yes.
That is true according to Woods v. Mercer when a case goes to trial, but at the summary judgment stage, the burden is still on the movement to establish as a matter of law that the cause of action is barred. Woods v. Mercer itself limits its holding to trial, and then Kruger v. Grohl, which is a 1990 writ denied case out of the 14th District Court of Appeals, clearly states that that burden does not shift until you are at the trial stage. So at the point that the court ruled on these motions,
it was... Take the scenario as they allege that the only summary judgment evidence in the record is that the agent, or that the case knew about the problem more than 2 years before the suit was filed. And that's the only date in there.
And I would like to address that, Your Honor.
And don't you have to respond and say, no, the discovery rule applies and this is what it is, then they got to come back and leave that.
Yes, Your Honor, and we did in the response to the motion for summary judgment and so forth. In fact, what the record shows is when Mr. Cates Jr. was being deposed and he was asked, when was the latest this conversation took place with the agent, the last conversation where Mr. Cates said, hey, what's going on? And the agent said, do what you need to do. It's clear that Mr. Cates testified that that happened either in 1980 or 1989. He was asked that simple question, when was the latest time this conversation took place? Answer was probably 89 or 90, I don't know. And through a series of other questions, he says, I don't know exactly when it was. Approximately 89, and in answer to the issue that was raised in the reply by Northwestern and counsel mentioned earlier, that particular page of Mr. Cates' testimony was clearly before the court when the first motion for summary judgment were heard. Northwestern itself attached that page of his testimony to their own motion in support of it. It was also before the court at that's at transcript 222, as counsel indicated. It was also before the court in Jackson National's materials in support of its motion at 563 of the transcript, months before the court heard and actually ruled on these first round of motions. So there's no question that the court had before the testimony of Mr. Cates that this last conversation, if you want to say that's when the statute should have started ticking, could have been in 90. Not only that, they asked him, do you remember whether it was winter or summer? No. So if this court has to accept as true the testimony favorable to Cates and indulge all reasonable inferences in his favor and resolve all doubts in his favor, it's clear, or at best there is a fact issue that this conversation with the agent took place.
What he didn't know happened after the date within 2 years of filing.
What happened, Your Honor, was when they had this conversation, whether it was in 90 or 91 when it was, Mr. Cates started checking with the insurance department and ultimately wrote the insurance companies, and that was in November of 91 when the companies wrote him back and said these policies had been lapsing, and he determined that there was a fictitious post office box listed in his name that this agent was taking the payments at. So I think at the earliest possible point this conversation with the agent would start the statute. I think under the discovery rule, Mr. Cates had a reasonable amount of time to make the inquiries to the insurance companies, which he did because the agent obviously wasn't going to tell him what was going on. So I don't think there's a problem with the statute of limitations, even if this court reviews it, and I certainly don't want to run from that. And again, the discovery rule, as far as it not being pled, is simply not a problem under the under the case law. The no damage contention is limited to just two of the plaintiffs. They concede that Ed Cates Jr., who purchased the policy and paid some $6,000 to $10,000 over this 3 year period to the agent when he would get some kind of notice that indicated that the policy premium was due, he'd call the agent. The agent would say, I'll take care of it, the coverage is okay, would take his cash and obviously was not tending to his business. But it does apply, as I understand it, to Mr. Cates Sr., who is the beneficiary of the policy, and Mr. Ward, who is the insurer. But those gentlemen, starting with Mr. Cates Sr., he was the beneficiary of about $500,000 worth of life insurance coverage on these policies that were issued. He no longer is. Now, Mr. Ward is still alive. He has not died. He has some medical conditions, and he's uninsurable at this point. But Mr. Cates Sr., because of the conduct of the agent and the companies, no longer has the coverage that he is a beneficiary of. We also pled, obviously, the element of mental anguish. So there's no negating of damages as a matter of law, and the same reasoning applies to Mr. Ward. He was an insurer to the tune of about $500,000 at one point, and because of the acts of the agent, he no longer is. So there's certainly damages that have been pled with respect to those two and that are provable. Briefly, the mid-continent points. First of all, apparent authority was raised. I think we pled it. We pled in our petition that Agent Butler was acting within the scope and course of his authority for these companies. We didn't use the word apparent or actual. We just said authority. But to the extent it wasn't in the petition, it was raised clearly in our responses to the motion for summary judgment and in our brief. So that's not a new issue. I have admittedly some problem following Mid-Continent's reasoning as to its own order. And if you'll recall, they got the summary judgment granted on the same two grounds that the others did, and the additional grounds about there being no policy, and as the trial court found, no agency relationship or employee relationship between Mr. Butler and Mid-Continent. The Court of Appeals obviously considered all four of those grounds because it discussed them in the opinion. I know that speaks for itself. There are two things the Court of Appeals held that I think clearly reject all of Mid-Continent's claims about why they should still be entitled to summary judgment. One of those conclusions was that there was evidence of at least apparent authority in this case. I still say there's plenty of evidence of actual authority, but the Court of Appeals didn't address that. If there's evidence of apparent authority, there's a fact issue before the court, and that's why the Court of Appeals rejected the ground on the no authority, that this agent didn't have any authority to misrepresent anything. It also fully explains why they rejected the trial court's finding that there was no agency relationship or employee relationship between the agent and the company, because clearly if there's a apparent authority or an apparent agency, those are negated. Same thing for the fact that no policy was issued. That does not, as the court showed, negate apparent authority for this agent to represent that there was coverage. Court of Appeals also concluded that the trial court's order did not dispose of all claims against or as to all parties dealing again with these claims against insurance companies. That rejects flatly the second ground of Mid-Continent, and that is that the company didn't violate the DTCA or the insurance code. It just doesn't reach the question of whether these companies were negligent in failing to uncover and warn about what was going on with this agent. As far as apparent authority, there's again some evidence in the record. Mid-Continent accepted some blood samples and admitted in their letter to Mr. Cates in 1991, yes, we did get some blood samples on Mr. Ward. Agent Butler would come around, sign him up on these policies, and get him to a physical and so forth and send it in. So they accepted the blood samples. The agent would show Mr. Case checks that he purportedly had written to Mid-Continent to cover the checks that Mr. Case had written to Agent Butler. So there's no proof in the record that Mid-Continent accepted or endorsed that check, because obviously or at least apparently the agent was putting it in his own pocket. But there is plenty of evidence in the record as to that. So our position, just simply put, is that under existing law, Novak, without abrogating the clear rule that a summary judgment order that does not dispose of all parties and all issues is not final. It's interlocutory. This court need not reach the review of these alternative grounds. But if you do, on the record that this court has, it's clear that that Northwestern hasn't established as a matter of law both that the cause of action accrued longer than 2 years before the suit, and certainly not as a matter of law as to when Mr. Butler or Mr. Cates should have discovered his injury, which again was in 1991, according to the record. But if this court gets to those issues, then we're confident that the result's going to be the same. The Court of Appeals' opinion or judgment that the case has to be remanded to the trial court for resolution is fully sustainable and should in fact be affirmed.
Did the Court of Appeals remand because they found the fact issue or because it was an interlocutory order, as you argue now?
I think they said both. They cite the Novak case and the general rule.
You don't have a point of error here in response to them that, well, we don't get to hear it at all because it's interlocutory.
I'm not sure how directly we discussed that in our response to the application, Your Honor. I want to think that we did cite Novak and the rule that you cannot appeal a summary judgment order that... I know we cited the general rule. I'm
not
sure.
The only rule in Novak is that if it's a denial, you can't appeal it. It doesn't really say that it's interlocutory. Is your point that because he denied the two grounds, that makes that order interlocutory and you can't appeal it?
Because the motions themselves and the trial court's orders did not even get to the negligence questions against the companies. It was never resolved by the trial court, and those are still pending.
All right. Thank you.
And the case just simply never should have been dismissed.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
First of all, the issue of whether or not the final judgment was interlocutory or final is not before the court. It was never raised at the point of error for this court. It was never even briefed in the brief that was filed, and the trial court concluded that this was not interlocutory. The reference to the Novak case has nothing to do with whether or not the final judgment was interlocutory or final, because in our case, the summary judgment was not denied, it was granted. And there were just happened to be two grounds of that summary judgment in which we sought review of to support affirmance of the trial court's judgment. Number two, the issue of when this last conversation takes place is easily resolved by reading page 222 of the record, because both counsels are citing to that page as to when they believe the last conversation took place, and I think it's clear it's 1989, and that page speaks for itself. But nonetheless, the confrontation took place in 1989, and there's no dispute over that. And that confrontation is set forth on page 224 of the record. Finally, with respect to this no damages point of error, comically, although seriously, two of the respondents testified in their deposition, which was filed a year after the lawsuit, or which was taken a year after the lawsuit was filed, that they had never authorized suit to be filed on their behalf. They didn't even know that they were parties to a lawsuit when I was deposing them until I informed them during the deposition. They didn't even know there was a lawsuit. They testified they weren't seeking any money or any damages from any of the defendants. They both testified they didn't even know why they were a party to a suit, never mind sitting across the table from me answering my questions. So clearly those facts show that regardless of whether or not they may have suffered damages, they sure aren't seeking any recovery from any of the petitioners that are before this court. Thank you.
Good question. Thank you, counsel. Any further rebuttal? That concludes the argument and the second call. The court will now take a brief recess.